Thank you. So on the light also of yesterday's discussion, I have decided to give a talk that is a bit of a journey into three different topics that apparently are very different from each other. You have heard already something about earthquakes. You haven't heard anything about solar flares. And you have heard from me something about brain activity. Why I'm doing this? Because as my subtitle says, the attention of the people in this workshop, but also in the community, in the literature, is mainly on the power laws, the exponent, how we can find the better exponent, which are the effective exponents, the true exponents, and so on. And what I would like to discuss today is really this the only information we need? Is this really giving us the physics of the phenomenon that we are studying? And I will try to show you that the answer is no. That means the power law exponents for the distributions, the static distributions, are certainly of interest, but they are a bit like the top of the iceberg. So they hide the real physics that can be very different and very complex of the different problems, and you have to develop tools to discriminate, because power laws exponent distributions do not. And of course, I will start with earthquakes, because earthquakes are the most studied problems so far. You have to realize that the first statistical law for earthquakes is at the end of the 19th century. So there is more than a century of statistical studies on earthquakes. And here, especially in California, there is an extremely intense activity, research activity on the subject. And I will actually invite you to visit this website, Collaboration for Study of Earthquakes Prediction. If you study, go to this website, you will see that in the world there are four centers: California, LA, Zurich, ETH, New Zealand, and Japan, where there are group of peoples that since years are applying different stochastic methods for the prediction of earthquakes. So it's not just a sentence by Per Buck that can just erase the work of an entire community. And you will see that there are different models, that there are very serious people, and I think we have, as physicists, first to understand what they do, and then to do something different. And this is a bit the approach we have followed, and this is just the number of collaborators. So what I'm trying to summarize today is the work of a large number of people. Of course, my main collaborators on the brain activity are Hans Hermann at ETH and my friend Carla Perrone Capano, who is a neurobiologist. But I have the support of the Dietmar Plenz at NIH for experimental data and Dante Chialvo in Argentina. These are my students who work on the subject. On earthquakes is mostly a Napolitan team, but after actually 8 years, we finally were able to collaborate with the chief of the earthquake prediction in Italy, that is Werner Marzocchi, and is actually the responsible for CEP for the Italian earthquake network. So, I mean, requires some work to be accepted by the community. And finally, on solar flares is a work that I do between Naples and Zurich. So the first question, I mean, the motivation of this talk is the fact that in recent years, so you see the dates, a number of also very important papers, like paper published on Nature, Science, and so on, have shown that in natural phenomena, very different from each other, you observe power law distributions. And of course, coming from critical phenomena, this has been interpreted as the system that could be the Earth system, the, let's say, the rainfall system, or the solar flare system, as a system that acts close to a critical state. The problem we are analyzing, the first problem we are analyzing, is this one. You have certainly seen a seismic map before. And the beauty of this map is that it's clear that there is a temporal spatial clustering, because earthquakes occur over along faults, and faults are just the boundary between tectonic plates that continuously move under the turbulent motion of the magma that is underneath. So the earth crust is made of a lithosphere that is rigid, but then there is underneath the asthenosphere that is in continuous movement, and this represents the drive for the tectonic plates. So as you see here, from this is the time occurrence of earthquakes, you see that you have a very large number of small earthquakes, and you have very few large earthquakes. This is the world map. So again, already this data suggests that the distribution is not a Gaussian or any trivial distribution, but the distribution is a power law. So how can we characterize an earthquake? The earthquake usually is characterized by the physical quantity that is called the seismic moment. The seismic moment is the product, by definition in mechanics, the shear modulus, the fracture area, so the part, the area of the fault that actually slips, and the length of the slip. Of course, this number can have a spread of values that is huge. So what people usually do, and this was already done in 54, they introduce a new quantity that is on a logarithmic scale, that is the magnitudo. The conversion between the seismic moment, the more physical quantity, and the magnitudo is given by the Kanamori-Anderson law, that is a phenomenological law. This implies that the amplitude of the earthquake must be measured on a specific seismograph, the Wood-Anderson seismograph. So there are all kinds of requirements you have to follow. And by a triangulation method of at least three seismic stations, you arrive to determine these quantities. What is the beauty of these quantities is that their distribution is a power law. This is the result first found by Kagan, and for the seismic moment, whereas on what we are more used to look at is the Gutenberg-Richter law in a semi-log scale that gives you a straight line. So if you use the magnitudo, the Gutenberg-Richter law is an exponential decay.
Is P a rate?
The probability. The probability to observe an earthquake larger than n is a cumulated distribution.
So why does it not go to 1 in your graph?
Sorry, this is not normalized. This specific figure is not normalized. That's not correspond to. So this coefficient B is a coefficient that has been studied a lot, depends, B is close to 1, but depends on the geographic area. Now there are recent Nature and Science paper that tell you that B depends also on the kind of fault you have. So there is still a lot of research on the parameters to put into this law. So if you use physical quantities, the distribution of earthquake size is a power law. If it's a power law, this means that there is no characteristic size. I can observe many small earthquakes, but I can observe also big ones. And this is certainly in agreement with what we have learned in critical phenomena, where close to the critical point, there is no characteristic size. So this scale invariance would suggest to look at correlations. So let's look, and we focus mainly on temporal correlations. Are there temporal correlations in earthquake occurrence? And this is the first statistical law, as I was telling you, the Omori law. That means the Omori law tells you that if I have a large earthquake occurring, let's say, at a certain time t equals 0, in time, the number or rate of events after this big event decays as a power law with an exponent close to 1. So you must set your clock at the occurrence of the main, what we call the main event, the mother event, and after the mother event, there will be a high number, large number of closing times events that decay as a power law. This is a cartoon. It's not the real. It's not the real sequence. It's just to tell you that you can imagine the earthquake catalog as the ensemble of many Omori law. Each big earthquake will generate its own Omori law.
The question is, how do you define the main event or the mother? Mm-hmm. This is the whole.
So. The other typical law is the productivity law. So the number of daughters that an event can have, or son, depending on the point of view, is depends on the magnitude of the mother. So the larger is the main event, the higher will be the number of triggered events. Here in this law, there is this C parameter that is very important because avoids divergences at short times. And as you see, these are the four largest earthquakes in California. You have a first regime, almost constant, the C value regime, and then you have a decay like 1 over P. The problem is, as Stefano was saying, that this analysis is beautiful, but requires that you are able to discriminate between what is a main event and what is an aftershock. So all these events that are triggered by the main event are called aftershocks of the main event. And in the literature, in recent years, there has been a huge number of so-called declustering methods. The declustering methods are the methods that allow you, looking at the catalog, and the catalogs are free. They are on the USGS website, so everybody can get this data, get hold of this data. And looking at the data, how can I discriminate? It's not easy at all. And as soon as a new declustering method comes out in the literature, there are as many papers who just try to show that this declustering method is no good. So, I mean, it's a tough road to follow looking at the Omori law. So what has been done recently is has been introduced a completely different approach. First of all, the first hypothesis that is crucial at this point is to consider an earthquake as a point event in time. So you neglect the duration of an earthquake, which is reasonable because even a big earthquake lasts tens of seconds, no more, and the time between events is certainly larger than the duration. So a catalog for you can be seen like a temporal sequence of events of different magnitudes, and with the time where actually nothing happens. And the trick is that you don't focus on the event, but you focus on the times where nothing happens, disregarding completely the nature of the event. So you treat on the same footing the mother, what is called the main shock, and the aftershocks. So you look at the distribution of these quiet times or waiting times or inter times. In the literature, there are several names for this data. Why is this interesting? It's interesting for two reasons. For a Poisson process, so a process that is uncorrelated, where events occur at constant rate, you can prove analytically that this distribution is an exponential. And this is something that occurs for a number of phenomena. This is a figure taken by one of the millions paper of Barabasi, and I think it's the mail exchange or something like this. So there are Poisson processes where the intertime distribution is exponential. But more interestingly, it's been shown by Utsu that if instead there are correlations in your process, so if the rate is not constant, but is a power law of time, why power law? Because it's what we have for the Omori law, you can prove analytically exactly that the P of delta T is as a power law regime. So what you actually expect in this intertime distribution, if there are no correlations, it's simply an exponential. If there are correlations. A power law regime over the temporal scale where correlations are relevant, and then eventually at longer intertimes an exponential decay.
Well, and just for me to understand, does that mean if I assume for a frequency, let's say it's called frequency alpha, if I assume it's related as a power
what
law?
What is alpha?
I just call it alpha.
Okay.
If I assume that alpha is related to the event size as a power law, then I would get a power law distribution of...
No, size, no. You have that the rate depends in time. So the rate of occurrence goes like t minus p,
okay.
T to the minus p, like the Omori law. There is this paper by Utsu that proves exactly that p of delta t is a power law with an exponent that is related to the p you put in the rate.
So exponent in, exponent out.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter what the magnitude cutoff is for your series? You make these are discrete events, you have to pick a magnitude cutoff.
I will come to this point.
Also, question is, I have a question. If I deal only with mother events, what is p of delta t for mother events?
If I am sure to take only the mother events,
yeah,
which for the reason I just said is not sure at all,
yeah,
and I just look at the intertime distribution of mother events are Poissonian. So
okay.
I would find
that's what I wanted to say.
So this is a good point. A seismic catalog, if you want, just want to give a zero level definition, is the ensemble of two different kinds of events. A number of Poissonian events that are the mother that generates the Omori sequences that are the correlated events. So, of course, you already understand that for the Poissonian, there is very little you can do forecasting-wise. You cannot predict a Poissonian
yeah,
event.
That's what I wanted to say.
But if you're sitting in an Omori law,
yeah,
you have a remarkable work to do. And consider also that in reality the social need is for the prediction of aftershocks because are usually the one that cause most social damage are the aftershocks because you already weaken the structure if you think of a building
okay.
with a main shock. So if you are able to predict aftershocks, usually these are the ones. And then, I'm not talking at all about foreshocks, but I will show just a slide on foreshocks. So, where you are sitting in a correlated temporal regime, there, I'm not saying the problem is solved. The problem is not solved, but then there is work to do.
Yeah.
If, of course, you want to predict a Poissonian event, you cannot.
So, mother events are still not predictable by anybody?
Unless these mother events have, I'll show you, a number of precursors that is not observed for all mother events. There are earthquakes, like, for instance, the Northridge earthquake in California, that had no precursor. But then precursors can be everything, can be radon emission, can be electromagnetic waves, can be motion of the aircraft. There is not just the foreshock.
But it also depends on the definition of prediction. If you've got a statement like there's a big event every 10,000 years rather than every 2 days.
I will show you what prediction is for a seismologist.
Okay.
I took into account your request. Yesterday's request. So, this is what happens for earthquakes. This is a paper that had a lot of citation by Alvaro Corral in Barcelona, and this is the intertime distribution obtained for different areas of the world as was suggesting, choosing different cutoff thresholds for the magnitude. Of course, if you put different cutoff thresholds, you lose the small events, so you lose the small intertimes, and probably you are increasing the larger ones. You have less delta t, so the overall rate decreases, and you have a different distribution that usually shifts toward the right. What is the beauty of the result of Corral? Is that Corral showed that if you think that there is a characteristic time in the phenomenon that is the inverse of the average rate for that catalog, and you rescale intertimes by the rate, that is 1 over average delta t, you have a generalized scaling function that collapses all the curves. So there is a characteristic time, and the scaling behavior is basically universal, in quotation. There is a gamma function, there is an initial power law regime, and there is an exponential decay. Indeed, of course, there is not a perfect collapse. At a small delta t, there is no agreement with the gamma distribution. There have been many, many papers by Sornet, Sachev-Fenn Sornet, about this issue. And the problem is that the scaling with a single characteristic time is not sufficient. You have more characteristic times in your scaling simply because the C in the Omori law does not scale with the rate. So basically, you have a more generalized scaling with 4 characteristic times, and if you take into account all the 4 characteristic times, you have perfect collapse. Okay? Delta t is the time where nothing happens.
Okay, so the inter-event time or something like that. But then you need to introduce a threshold, don't you?
This is what I said. So I change, the threshold for me is mc. I change mc. As you see, when I put the threshold here, I have this larger inter-time, is what he was asking before. And if I do this, I change the distribution because I lose the short inter times, I gain larger ones, and I actually, overall, I have a smaller number of inter times. But if I rescale by the rate that has changed, because the total number of delta t has changed, the distribution becomes universal. And this made the chorale very famous.
So if MC is big enough, then I should recover an exponential, because I would assume that the big events are Poissonian.
Sure.
So how close is that exponent to 1, which I would suspect?
For earthquakes, this is small. It's of the number of 0.6, the order of 0.6.
How do you relate to
This exponent should be of the order, if I can predict your question, is should be related to P. Is this what you wanted to know? Okay.
You just mentioned that before. How do you relate characteristic time with the C of the Omori law?
You cannot.
You
can't. That's why you need a second characteristic time.
Okay.
So the more general scaling. I can show you the paper. This is a work we did. I try not to fill up slides with my own works, so that's why I try also to say things running away, but this doesn't help. There is a paper that shows that if you introduce 4 characteristic times, because what is also important is the fraction of aftershocks with respect to main shocks, and if you have a more complex scaling than this one, this is really, really the zero level one, you collapse also the small delta t. I can give you the reference. Okay?
Is there any issue of what spatial distance you consider the fraction?
Thanks for this question. So, since I knew that my talk should be constrained into 1 hour, I chose deliberately to ignore all the spatial part. And it's something I'm not addressing, and in fact, my talk is called about temporal correlation. But since I couldn't resist, I have 2 slides about it. But now I can tell you are absolutely right. Most of the work of seismologists is on the spatial part. Seems like the spatial organization of event contains even more information than the temporal one. And you will see, there is a very telling feature I will show you. So this is for earthquakes. But then let's make a big jump, levy flight, to something completely different. And this is the solar flare phenomenon. You just drop on this problem by chance, because we realized that on the NASA website, there are catalogs of data collected by the satellites, in principle, the GOES satellites is the best one. And what happens is that the solar corona is a plasmon in turbulent flow. So you have that magnetic tube lines in active regions that are characterized by sunspots. Magnetic tube lines are twisted because the footprints move following the fluid velocity, the plasma velocity, but also due to the vorticity, since you are in a turbulent regime, due to the vorticity, they twist. So this tube becomes twisted, and eventually this tube reconnects due to twisting. So by twisting, releases all this energy, and you have big eruption of energies in the sun. Now we are in a particularly active region, active period. So you see, this is the solar cycle that is about 11 years. So contrary to the seismic catalog, where the Poissonian rate is constant, for the sun, the rate is periodic, with a periodicity of 11 years, and the number of sunspots has been calculated, evaluated since the 18th century. So the idea was, let's try to see what happens if I look at the same distributions. And people had looked in the astrophysical literature to the distribution of solar flare size, the distribution of intertimes, but in astrophysics there was not such a thing as an O'Moore law. So we look at the three of them, and you can see that the earthquake data, that are the red ones, actually can be collapsed. The collapse is obtained by appropriately choosing the reference value T0, S0, and so on for each catalog, so you can actually collapse them. But you see the exponent, even if you don't collapse them, they will be parallel lines. The exponent is comparable for the three set of data.
I would have thought that all the interesting stuff is in the tail. Why don't they collapse the data? I'm sorry, why don't they bin the data? I mean, this is
because we want
nothing, right? Right now you can't see anything.
Well, the data is not really interesting here, because what you is interesting in the intertime is the tail is the thing that is more susceptible to noise. Indeed, there is no log binning. We chose to show just the raw data. This is our data. But indeed, what you are interested in, what it contains the physics, is the fact that you have an initial power law light regime in the intertime distribution, and you have a power law distribution in the rate. So even if you have the tail, you agree that the graph would have been much nicer.
You would be able to see the intermediate regime much better, and
it's
you would
okay.
be able to identify the scaling function.
We didn't, but for the sake of argument, we were not after the let's say the precise determination of exponents. The message I want to give is that this distribution can be very similar for phenomena that are quite different, because you have to imagine that elastic energy, that is the energy in an avalanching process, no? As we understand earthquakes, there is redistribution of elastic energy in the event earthquake. So you it's difficult to accept that the distribution of elastic energy and magnetic energy follows exactly the same idea. So this is the question. So this slide was presented just to open the question. He is looking at distribution and struggling to have exact exponent, really, what contains all the physics, I mean, giving answer to detect the physics. And from our point of view, this was not really sufficient. And since the largest catalog is the earthquake catalog, we started looking at the 30 years catalog for the California earthquakes and try to define correlation functions. But as you see, if I study the correlation function for the energy released in an event, that is the magnitudo, you have an extreme extremely noisy catalog. How do I see that it's extremely noisy? Because the real data are the black dot. This is the usual correlation function. And the red data are the data of the correlation function in a catalog where magnitude have been reshuffled in time with respect to the occurrence time. So you keep the time fixed, but then you reshuffle the value of the magnitude. So by definition, the correlations are zero, you have killed them, but then the spread of data gives you an idea of the standard deviation. So unless the very tiny temporal window at the beginning, at very short, for very short event, you actually cannot discriminate the presence of correlations among energies of event or not. So we decided to develop a new method for earthquake catalogs that actually detrains the noise in a catalog, and is actually pretty powerful because it's based on the evaluation of a conditional probability. So I evaluate for each couple of successive events, I calculate the time distance, the energy difference, where this is the magnitude, and I calculate the probability to observe that two events have a magnitude difference smaller than M0, given that their temporal distance is smaller than T0, where M0 and T0 are two parameters that I can vary and study this conditional probability for different values of M0 and T0. So for each value of the parameter, I have one number, and then I vary the parameter and I have a function. And the conditional probability is very easy to calculate because I just have to count all those couples of successive events that satisfy the conditions, and within this subset, detect the couples and count the number that satisfy the condition also on energy. Of course, this gives me a number, and this will be, for instance, the red line, the red vertical lines for a couple M0 and T0. This, of course, would not help much because it doesn't give me the idea of the statistical error bar. Then what I do? I calculate the same number in a catalog where magnitudes are reshuffled with respect to times. If I reshuffle them, the catalog is uncorrelated. And I do this reshuffling many, many times, let's say 10,000 times. For each realization, I have a number, and I construct the distribution of these numbers. This distribution is a Gaussian, as I expect, no? So I then compare the Gaussian of values I have in an uncorrelated catalog with the value I have in my catalog. If the value in the real catalog falls into the Gaussian, I would say that the real catalog is a realization compatible with an uncorrelated catalog. Otherwise, if it shifts to the right, so if the distance between the average value of the Gaussian and the value of the real catalog is greater than the standard deviation, that for me will be the error bar, I would say that relevant correlations exist in the real catalog. So the quantity of interest now for me is this horizontal line, is the distance between the average value in the Gaussian and the real value of in the real catalog. If this distance goes to zero, means there are no correlations. If it's different than zero, compatible with error bars, means I have correlations. It's very easy to implement. And this is what we find. Look at the black data that are the experimental data. This is a function of the earthquake size and for different delay threshold. You see that the curves corresponding to different T0 are well separated from each other. So there is really a temporal effect. Really, the distance between the Gaussian and the single value decreases as the events get farther apart, from 1 hour to 50 hours. Then there is a clear peak, And this is the cumulated distributions because I have a greater than sign. But if I take the derivative, you see that the probability has a clear peak at positive values or negative values of M0. What does it mean? It means that the difference in energy between the successive energy and the previous one, the successive magnitude and the previous one, is a negative number. So magnitudo are not uncorrelated in seismic catalogs, but typically in the correlated regime, that means in the Omori sequences, the following earthquake will be close in value, but smaller than the previous one. And this is something actually everybody noticed in reality. I mean, the earthquakes, the aftershocks tend to become smaller and smaller in size, but this is actually the first time you can quantify this dependence from the real data. So the idea is, I told you to look only at the black data, but then let's back to the forecasting problem. Can we forecast this in a model? So because if we are able to formulate a model that is, can reproduce this probability, means it can reproduce the energy time organization of events, and let's say is a first step toward forecasting. So there are different models in geophysics, but since 1988, since the seminal work of Agata that introduced the ETAS model, epidemic type aftershock model, aftershock sequences, what people use is a branching model that evaluates the probability to observe an event of magnitude M at times T, given the entire seismic history of the region. So the curly brackets is the history of past events, is what you get if you take a catalog. And the hypothesis is that you can actually choose, write this as the superposition. You apply, you think that the Earth class is an elastic linear regime, and you write this probability as the superposition of 2 points event in time, as the conditional probability of observing one event given the occurrence of each of the previous events that occur in time. And you superpose them. Plus, you have this Poissonian term, that is the Poissonian rate times the Gutenberg-Richter distribution. So the whole trick is to write this two-point conditional probability. And what seismologists do, usually write these conditional probabilities in terms of phenomenological laws. So here you see the Gutenberg-Richter law, the Omori law, and the productivity law. So this is what is called the ETAS model, is what people mostly use when they do forecasting in seismicity. But of course, I mean, we came with the idea of being able to propose something different. Why? Because this approach doesn't include at all the result I just showed you. This approach doesn't consider that magnitudo are correlated in time. And we saw this from the previous graph.
Is this supposed to be all events?
All events in the history.
Not just dimensions,
but all events. No. You want to bypass the discrimination main after, because it's very difficult to have everybody agree with the classical methods. So coming from critical phenomena, our idea was to say, I have two events of different energy, magnitudo MI and MJ, and what I'm saying is that their energy difference, fixes a time scale for correlation. So I fix a characteristic time that is a constant, and scales with the energy difference. So just to explain what this means, consider, for instance, two events, an event of magnitude 6 and event of magnitude 2. If I put 6 and 2 in this formula, b is 0.89, I see that a magnitude 2 event can be correlated to a Mother 6 over a time of 2 years. And this is absolutely reasonable. The Landers sequence in California lasted 4 years. If you have a big event like 6, the Omori sequence lasts for several years. However, if I have a magnitude of 5 after a magnitude of 6, this 5 is correlated to 6, so the difference is very small, only after a very short time. If I have a magnitude of 5 very far in time, what is probable is that 5 is Poissonian, is an independent event. So, defined in this way, I relate the energy difference between two events to the characteristic time of correlation. And then, in the spirit of critical phenomena, I say the conditional probability is invariant if the time distance is rescaled by this characteristic time. So I write my conditional probability as a generic function of the time distance rescaled by the characteristic time, where apparently the magnitude has disappeared, but has not disappeared because it's hidden in tau. What are the requirements for f? Very simple, must be a normalizable function. I should be able to integrate this function. As you see, I don't introduce phenomenological laws, but if I calculate from this probability the integral over time, so I calculate the distribution in magnitude of the entire catalog, you see that I come out with the Gutenberg-Richter law. If I integrate, conversely, on the magnitude of the mother events, and I look at the time dependence, I get something that scales like an inverse power law of time. So this specific form of the characteristic time that is actually driven by dynamical scaling arguments coming from statistical mechanics gives you as a byproduct the phenomenological laws that you don't need to introduce a priori as geophysicists do. And this is a picture of what forecasting means. Forecasting means that I take the California, this is the latitude and longitude of California, the California region is in the blue region, and these peaks are the probability of observing an event in California in the month of January 2003, given all the history of 30 years from 1973. These are the value evaluated with this dynamical scaling approach. The stars are the effective events that occurred in California in the month of January 2003. So this is to say something can be done. We haven't solved the problem, but something can be done. Consider that 90% of activity is on retrospective analysis. It's very difficult to do really prospective analysis nowadays.
But doesn't it just mean that where stuff is going on? I mean, doesn't it say, well, where we've got a lot of activity, you probably have events? I don't quite get where the prediction is.
The prediction is where your model predicts a probability different than zero, indeed, you observe events. Here you don't observe events, but there was a peak too. The model would not have worked if the stars were in the blue region.
The stars
are experimental data.
But isn't it true to say that when you see a lot of seismic events, you are going to see a lot of seismic events. So my simplest forecasting process would be, if you haven't got a lot of earthquakes, you will not have a lot of earthquakes. Isn't that precisely what's happening?
It's not so simple. You wouldn't have observed the earthquake in Emilia-Romagna under your reasoning, because in Emilia-Romagna there were no earthquakes since the 16th century.
So would you
and
have,
then there has been a devastating...
Would you have predicted it?
Well, there was no history. You must have an history.
That's the same for me.
Sure.
I haven't got history, so you just told me that because there wasn't any history, I wouldn't be able to predict. But you're not able to predict either.
Sure.
So why is my null prediction method, you sit there, if it shakes a lot, it's going to shake a lot, better or worse compared to your prediction method? I don't quite get what you gain.
No, I don't understand your point.
So I'm saying the simplest prediction method is to just measure the Poissonian rate. You just sit there and you check what the rate is of earthquakes. And then you say, this is probably going to be the rate for a long time.
Because this is not what happens in the Omori sequences. It's not Poissonian. You have very much closing time events. The Poissonian rate can be one event every several rates. It's a very low rate, the Poissonian one, you know?
So, yeah.
10 to the minus 6.
I understand that, yeah.
According to the Poissonian rate, you should observe no aftershocks. So you cannot predict with the Poissonian rate, because the majority of events in a catalog are the one you generate by the energy distribution avalanching of the main event that E is Poissonian.
I think what he's trying to say is that once I have an event, since I know there are aftershocks afterwards, I know there'll be aftershocks afterwards nearby.
She says, what is the magnitude of those aftershocks, and how long I should wait for that aftershock?
I can give a space-time window.
Yeah.
Not me. I mean, what the seismologist want to
do. This is where you beat me, right? You could give a space-time window.
I can give the point is to say, if there is an event that occurs in L'Aquila, the 4th of May, given the history, because the history in itself contains the faults that you cannot access. You don't know. I mean, the Sant' Andreas fault is a very particular case of a fault that is open air. But in Italy, you don't see the faults. So the history tells you where the faults are. So given the history and given the structure of the ground, what is the probability to observe? You cannot, you know, prevent seismic activity on an entire center Italy region, but you know that on a limited region, for instance, 50 kilometers by 50 kilometers, there is a high probability to observe an earthquake in the next 5 hours. And then you get people out of their houses. This is the main idea. Of course, you must give the space-time window. The Poissonian rate doesn't allow you to do this, because the Poissonian rate doesn't predict aftershocks.
So you determine things in space, and you predict things in space and time.
I predict, yes, of course, here I'm only, I've only given the formula for time, but there is the space part that I haven't given, because otherwise I wouldn't get to the end of my talk.
Is this spectacular law, or does it have a mechanical justification, mechanical model?
If you let me, because this is, all this is probabilistic. But since I know that Pierre is particularly fond of physical models,
the Omori law, I mean, sometimes you have this parameter plus C in the denominator, sometimes not.
Yes. In this case, okay, here you can have a P. In this probabilistic laws, we neglect C. It's true.
Is it a big effect or not?
No, not really. This is obtained in this way. Also because each sequence has its own C, because C depends on the mother event. So you should consider an average value, because this is a characteristic time for the entire catalog. So you should consider an average C for everybody. And so this basically amounts to shift the time origin by a little bit. So this is just to tell you that for the catalog, the temporal catalog, you generate with this approach, you get the red data. So there is very good agreement between experimental and numerical data, which confirms that in an earthquake catalog, magnitudo are correlated in closing time events. The magnitude of the next one is slightly smaller than the magnitude of the previous one. Okay? Is what you expect. Yes. Usually this f of x is either a power law or an exponential. Depends how fast you want your program to converge, but there is no actual reason, no actual difference for between the two.
You don't measure it?
No, you put it. From the scaling point of view, the only requirement is normalizable. So you need, must be something that could be integrated. No, I don't measure. This is the...
I mean, from the formula above,
yeah,
you can measure it, no?
Like hitting data? Is that what you're saying?
From the data? Mm-hmm. I mean, I plot the right-hand side as a function of rescaled variable, and then I measure the function.
We didn't do it.
But
we just put it as, you know, a feedback. So, mechanical model. What is the model that we do? Because you can obtain the same set of data, you can obtain with a mechanical model. And the mechanical model that is, there are a number of mechanical models. And this is the Olarmi, Feder, and Christensen model, where the model is non-conservative, and the best agreement with the experimental data is for a degree of dissipation in this interval. A conservative model is alpha 1/4, that means 1/4 of the content to each site. Here, an earthquake is the number of sliding blocks, and you can actually generate a large, you make large number of simulations. And in this paper, we do the same analysis I show you for the dynamical scaling with this mechanical model. So what is the idea? Is that the occurrence of a big event propagates elastic stress in the system. Now there are more recent models introduced by Jagla and co-workers where the diffusion of the elastic stress occurs through viscoelastic relaxation in the plasma. So there is a complex coupling also of viscoelastic relaxation. And this triggers event far in time. So here I show you a nice experimental picture. You see On the horizontal axis, you have the main shock for the sequence at time e equals zero. On the right, you have all the instant of time after the main shock, and on the left, you have the time preceding the main shock. On the y-axis, I have the inverse average distance of each event in the catalog from the future main shock. Okay? So what you see is that as the time of the main shock gets closer, you have a sort of migration of events called foreshocks toward the epicenter of the future main shock. So there is a localization process in space toward the future epicenter. Then there is the event occurring, and you have a relaxation outward due to stress diffusion. So this graph is to tell you that the spatial organization of events, if there are foreshocks, and certainly for the main shocks, the spatial organization is a very important information. And now, the community is focusing on these properties. There are many, Nature, Felser, Lembrowski, and people like this who are studying the spatial organization of foreshocks and aftershocks. And this is just I don't want to get into details, otherwise we'll never end. But then, what happens if I do the same analysis, statistical analysis, for solar flares? If I do the same statistical analysis, I see that the peak in the distribution is not on lambda, where lambda is the ratio between successive energy, is not on lambda smaller than 1, but is for lambda greater than 1. So for solar flares, closing time events are correlated in energies, but the energy of the following one is slightly larger than the energy of the previous one. The distributions are the same. They collapsed, I showed you. But the correlation, energy correlation analysis done in this way shows this difference. So the idea was with Anserman has this wonderful postdoc who masters Lattice Boltzmann, and they have a cluster of GPU cards, graphic cards. So we made this huge simulation, simulating the solar corona, or part of the solar corona, so a plasma, in turbulent flow, so in the Kolmogorov regime for energy. And we have, we put in the plasma magnetic tube with the footprints anchored in the plasma, and the footprints move according to velocity, so they have a displacement, but also can twist, can rotate due to the vorticity of the velocity field. And eventually, if the twist gets a critical value, you have reconnection. So you can tune the different ingredients. You can tune the plasma fluid. You can tune the number of tubes, the interaction among tubes, the avalanching criterion, if it's on twisting or not, and see what reproduces the statistical laws. And this is what we do. And this is actually quite interesting. If you have random walk of the footprints, the size distribution is just an exponential. And this was the original work of Hughes, Patsuski, and so on, at PRL, that actually has motivated this work. So they weren't able to find the power law. To find the power law in the size distribution, you need turbulent flow. So the responsible for the power law distribution in energy is the fact that the plasma is in turbulent flow. But if you have only one tube, if you have several tubes non-interacting, or you have several tubes interacting, this doesn't change the energy distribution. The energy distribution is the most robust law. It depends only on the turbulent flow. Then we look at the intertime distribution. And for the intertime distribution, given that the fluid is in turbulent flow, we can tune the interaction. If I have a single tube, I have an exponential decay, but I can reproduce experimental decay. If I have random motion, I have an exponential decay. I can reproduce the experimental data only if I have several tubes interacting with each other. Okay, so the temporal organization, the intertime distribution, is driven by the interactions. But then interactions can be of different size, of different type. In earthquakes, the interaction is destabilizing. I distribute elastic energy, so a site close by that was stable can become unstable. But conversely, the interaction can be stabilizing. Why? Because by distributing energy, you increase the pressure in the plasma, and increasing the pressure in the plasma, you stabilize, you decrease the twisting of your tube. So we verify the two different scenarios. And instead, what we found out is that to reproduce experimental data in solar flares, so to have that the next event is larger in energy than the previous one, the avalanching process of event does not have to have a destabilizing effect as for elastic energy, but must have a stabilizing effect. That means the tube that was close to instability becomes more stable. So with this ingredient, you reproduce all the, you can make the difference. You can say solar flares and earthquakes behave differently. So at this point, I don't know if I have any time left. Probably not. I do, I have 5 minutes, great. So I use 5 minutes for the brain, and because the brain is another phenomenon where the size distribution of avalanches follows a power law with an exponent 1.5, close to 1.6, not precisely 1.6. For different animals, different experiments in vitro, in vivo, and so on, and also for numerical data. Okay? So I don't give you the details of the model. Everybody's is willing, I mean, I'm delighted to give details on the model if you want, but I just want to follow the same fil rouge to get to the final message. Let me look at the intertime distributions for neuronal avalanches. So I look at times in my slice, cortex slice, where I have no electrical activity. And I see that for neuronal systems, this distribution that you see is, as in general, this behavior, gamma function, power law, and exponential, becomes, for the first time in the literature, non-monotonic. You have an initial power law regime. These are seven different slices. Then you have a minimum, more or less pronounced, and then you have a following maximum. So the crucial ingredient is that the behavior is non-monotonic. So then with Dittmar plants, we were puzzled and tried to understand why we have this non-monotonic behavior in cortex slices. And the answer is that the activity in the brain is not a constant rate as for earthquake, and not even a periodic rate as for solar flares, but is given by the alternation of high activity periods, where avalanches are highly correlated with each other and follow a power law distribution, and periods where there is a disfacilitation for the system. Why disfacilitation? Because it's a living system. The neurotransmitters vesicles just, there is shortage of neurotransmitters vesicles in the synapses. There is accumulation of external magnesium that actually can block receptor, is a molecule that fits into the receptors and blocks the access of the neurotransmitters. Or you have accumulation of, for instance, adenosine, that is an inhibitor of neurotransmitter release. So it's the molecular biology that sets in a number of mechanisms that tell the system, now you have to be quiet. And this is not periodic. This depends on the level of activity of the previous substrate. So the more the system is active, the longer it must be quiet. And there is this alternation between upstates and downstates. If you implement this in a model that is a neuronal network, you can actually reproduce very well the experimental data. And what is interesting is that there is a balance in nature, in life, there is a balance between excitation and inhibition that makes the system working at its best. If in my model I increase excitation, and here by increasing excitation I mean dynamical excitation, I can lead the neuron to fire more compulsively, I must also increase the dynamical inhibition to recover experimental data. What is important is only the ratio between this dynamical excitation and dynamical inhibition. So well-balanced neuronal system have an optimal ratio of excitation and inhibition, and this optimal ratio is the condition under which I observe power laws for the average size distribution.
In which sense is it optimal?
Optimal because I live in a virtual world. For me, optimal is I reproduce experimental data, but optimal means the size distribution is a power law. Okay. If inhibition is too strong, I have an exponential, the system is subcritical. If excitation is too strong, I have a bump, the system is supercritical. The condition that express the experimental intertime distributions are the condition that provide the power law scaling for the avalanche size. So the avalanche size is, as a power law, is the expression of an optimal balance that the system is able to establish self-consistently. Nobody's telling the cortical network to do this. Is the, are the biomolecular mechanisms that are able to install this mechanism. And finally, I conclude showing you the similar analysis I did for the fMRI data of Dante Chialvo, the same analysis for the conditional probability for humans lying in rest, close eyes, and fMRI data exhibit the same dynamical balance. That means in the human brain, healthy brain, periods of high excitations are correlated to periods of decreased excitation. There is, if I have an increase in activity somewhere in time, close by in time, there should be a decrease in activity because the system balanced excitation and inhibition dynamically. This has nothing to do with the percentage of excitatory and inhibitory synapses that everybody has with the birth and you cannot modify. This is a dynamical adjustment that the healthy brain operates. So I hope to have, coming back to yesterday's discussion, I hope to have convinced you that there is much more than power laws. And natural phenomena apparently can have the same statistical laws, but you have the tool to make the difference. And then life, this is my take-home message, life is brain activity, is a much more intriguing self-consistent mechanisms that are not present in other natural phenomena. And then I stop.
In the solar flare, can you also see do the avalanches always stabilize or can they sometimes destabilize?
We check both. I mean, the advantage of being a numerical person is that you have your model, it's like you have a recipe, and then you change, you put one ingredient at a time, and you see which ingredient adjusts your data to the experimental data. So we check both. We check tubes, 200 tubes in the solar corona, non-interacting, mm-hmm. And you cannot have the intertime distribution. You can have the size distribution, provided that you have turbulent flow. If they interact, I have the intertime distribution, but then they can interact in two ways, either with a stabilizing role or a destabilizing role. And we run both. We run both, and we saw, I showed you the data only for the one that worked. And if I use the destabilizing work, I get the earthquake data. So I get that the following flare has a magnitude smaller than the previous one.
I guess what I was asking, if there's an interaction where you can get both. Sometimes it stabilizes, sometimes it destabilizes.
We have to think about it.
How do they stabilize? Do they repulse, or can they also connect?
No, because the energy released to the nearby tubes increase the pressure in the plasma. Increasing the pressure in the plasma has the role of decreasing the twist. decreasing the twist gets the tube farther from threshold, for because this mechanism for triggering is the so-called kink instability. So there is a critical twist where the tube breaks and releases energy. Okay, so the increasing pressure due to the energy release decreases the twist.
Different tubes don't interconnect.
What we found...
I mean, you have two pairs like this, and then...
When do two tubes find... usually tubes interact... If two tubes get two footprints of different tubes, get in the same space localization, in the same point, then you have a flare. But statistically, the majority of flares, because you let them evolve, but you have to think that they are trapped in the vortex. So they follow the fluid vorticity because it's in a turbulent regime. So you don't have a random walk like in the original paper of Hughes et al. So usually they move like this, but they don't wander around very much. So the event you were saying is statistically less relevant than the kink instability event. Of course, we include also what you were saying.
Questions? If not, let's thank you again for the talk.